Right. My name is Deborah Schwartz. Today is Monday, September 21st, and I am sitting here with Gary Fisher. Gary, thank you so much for sitting and talking with me today. I represent the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Library, and you are participating in our oral history program here. And we are turning off phones. And I just want to say welcome and thank you for sitting down to talk with me and sharing with me your story.
Thank you. It feels very comfortable to be here.
So let's just start with a little bit of background information about you. I mean, people know your name.
Yeah.
So I won't go there first, but you are...
Well, I was born in 1950 at the Oak Knoll Naval Hospital, you know, over in Oakland. When I was 6 months old, and my father was in the Navy, we took a boat to Guam. My mother said I got tremendously seasick. We spent 2.5 years there, almost 3 years there. And then my mom decided she wanted to go home. We went back to Beverly Hills. And we lived with my grandfather and grandmother there in Beverly Hills. And my grandfather worked for Warner Brothers for 40 years. He worked for Hal B. Wallace before that for 10 years. He actually created what's called today American Broadcasting, which he'd bring people like Joan Crawford, Errol Flynn, Ronald Reagan to the house. I go out on set with him sometimes, and he taught me how to stand, how to look, how to speak, all these things. It was astounding. I used to spend summers down there, and I used to spend summers with my two sets of grandparents on my father's side up in Sacramento. And my father, well, his father was an architect, and my father was an architect. In fact, my father owned Fisher Friedman, and that was for maybe about 30 years, one of the larger architectural firms in San Francisco. They had an office right above Tadish's restaurant there, and they had the backdoor pass, let me tell you. And my parents lived in the house that they live in still today in Belvedere, and they're longtime members of the San Francisco Yacht Club. And my other, you know, ancestors.
Will you tell me your parents' name, please?
Bob and Saloma Fisher.
And your grandparents, the grandfather who was involved?
Fred Applegate.
The Applegate, he was in L.A.
Yeah, you go look in the Smithsonian and his desk and one of his script for Mickey Rooney's Midsummer's Night Dream in 1936 is there in the colored pencils that he used to annotate the script. He developed the job script director. And he did a lot of big movies. Anyway.
So you grew up here in Belvedere.
Later. We lived in Burlingame. Mm-hmm. I went to Burlingame High in freshman, sophomore. When I ended my sophomore year, we moved to Belvedere. I went to Redwood High, class of 68. And, you know, this whole... I started riding a bike down in Burlingame. And I was a member of a club called the Belmont Bicycle Club, or the BBC, and we had an Englishman as the guy. My father would take photos, and his stuff is incredible of bike racing in the 60s. You know, of 64 was the first year they had a national road championship, and that was actually down in Los Angeles. And before that, it was all, since 1932, had been just racing on the track. They didn't have any road racing. And Northern California in the 60s, mid-60s, was really Northern and Southern California, the renaissance of bicycle road racing. So I started in 62, as I was 12, and I was a road racer. And that was, you know, I rode the road, I rode the track. You know, the velodrome, there's a velodrome down in San Jose called Hellier Velodrome, mm-hmm. and I was there on opening day for this whole thing, you know, and I was a total diehard. I'm not going to do anything else but race a bike when I was like 12 years old. And I'll tell you, in school, they thought I was weird. It's not like today where the kids think bikes are cool. Oh, no. I mean, you either were a greaser and you wore Pegers, or you were a surfer, you know, and a bike guy, holy mackerel, little girl socks and black shorts and everything, you're weird. And, you know, and I got seen out on the road a few times, and they all talked about it in school, and I was an outcast. Oh, my God. And my mother, you know, it's really funny. I mean, I saw Dennis Christopher a couple of days ago. I've seen him a few times, and the guy was the star of Breaking Away.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, I'm telling him, you know, my mother told me that's a story about you. And that was a story about me. You know, I just, like, was into this stuff. I didn't care what anybody else thought. That was it. And then I was in a race in Fairfax. And it was, like, in 66. And they told me I couldn't race anymore because my hair was down just below my ears, like the Beatles, you know, and all that. And they told me I couldn't race. And, well, you know, the week before I'd been to a race down in Pescadero, California, and there were two bands playing, the Grateful Dead and the Quicksilver Messenger Service. And get this, man, they played two nights and maybe 100 people showed up, period, you know,
mm-hmm.
period, you know. And it was at point, like, if you wanted to get on stage and play with the band, you could. It was like that. And it was Free Love and Craziness. I was like 15. Jerry Garcia taught me how to roll a J on that thing, and Girl, you know, Quicksilver Girl, right? David Freiberg's wife, she grabs hold of me. We're making out in the straw field out behind. And I'm like going, whoa, I'm intoxicated. And I say, okay, you want to throw me out of bike racing? Fine. And, like, I sort of became runaway, you know, and I was always over in the hate. And they had, you know, 710 Ashbury and 715 where the band lived.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be living in one of those, working at the Carousel Ballroom. And I did some stuff, like I decorated the Jefferson Airplane Mansion.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun. I worked for those guys, and I worked for the dad sometimes. And I'd take care of, like, the bear, goodness gracious. And
what's the bear?
He was Augustus Stanley Owsley, and he made a lot of LSD. And he actually passed away 2 years ago in Australia by cause of an auto accident. The guy was healthy as could be. And he had quite the you know, the oranges, spaghetti, ketchup, steak, and milk. I always had to keep these in the refrigerator. That was his diet at that time. It was a pretty
paleo. Wait, say it again.
It was oranges, spaghetti, ketchup, steak, and milk.
Well, at least there's the fruit there.
Yeah, but that was like what made him, like, that was survival food in the house. Of course, we ate out all the time and stuff, you know,
yeah,
on the road.
So were there other people your age there living? This was sort of communal life, or was this?
Yeah, it was Jack Leary,
uh-huh.
Timothy's son,
uh-huh.
Same age.
Uh-huh.
We used to hang out,
uh-huh.
You know, at that time. And I survived in that scene until Altamont, and Altamont was the end.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because you had...
Got gritty then, huh?
Well, no. Here's what happened. It was like an insanity. And, like, in a way, it was a funny thing. You know, like, the Hells Angels we were using all the time.
Why don't you... Some of these people listening won't know what you're talking about.
No.
Maybe you can give a little preface about it.
Oh, goodness gracious. Anyway, the Altamont was something where the Rolling Stones were going to come to town. And we're going to have a big concert in Golden Gate Park with all the bands and everything. It was like, you know, East meets West. In a lot of ways, and it was like a really going to be a momentous thing, just in all that good energy and everything. So the city of San Francisco really wouldn't let us have that thing. And like, I was there at the very first meeting, and it was like Bill Thompson from the Jefferson Airplane,
mm-hmm.
Ron Racow from the Grateful Dead, Sam Cutler from the Rolling Stones, and Sonny Barger from the Hells Angels. And, you know, we always use the Hells Angels. Because we couldn't trust anybody else backstage. There were drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Come on. And the Angels were great. They were perfect. Anyway, this whole concert, we wanted to do it in San Francisco. The city wouldn't let us do it in Golden Gate Park or anywhere. And so we were going to Sears Point Raceway, and that fell through. And then Altamont came about, and it was awful. And what happened that made things go out of control with the Hells Angels was that they didn't have a very strict backstage list. There wasn't a whole procedure for that thing. And about 500 beautiful women got backstage. And the band managers are going to Sonny Barger, man, you're out of control.
You mean the Hells Angels let that?
Yeah, they let all these pretty girls in.
They just kept letting the girls in.
Yeah, the pretty girls. There were tons of them. Uh-huh. They all show up for the Rolling Stones. Uh-huh. Oh, my God. It was like completely on another level than anybody was used to, right? Uh-huh. And what's an angel do when they go out of control? They get violent. And that's what happened. And the whole vibe changed. Four people died, and it was an end of the 60s movement in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the bands, almost all the bands left town. You know, some went to Oakland, and most of them went to Marin. And then, you know, like, there were tribes of people that went to Kentucky, you know, and things. It was like the city cleared out, and I left, and I started living with a band called New Riders of the Purple Sage mm-hmm. over in Kentfield. And I started riding bikes again. And they say, hey, you got to meet this guy, Charlie Kelly. He's just like you. He's just like you. Okay, cool. I meet Charlie. Shit, he's got the same color bike I do. It's crazy, you know? And we're friends. And like,
Didn't you have another name? Didn't you go by another name?
Oh, with them, Spidey. Yeah,
Spidey?
Back with the band, you know? But then that went away, you know, absolutely. Because the other thing that came in was there's a lot of bad drugs, you know, and it was cocaine. And they come... Man, I never forget, this guy comes from New York, and he lays out this huge tin of coke, you know, at one of the Grateful Dead houses, and he's saying, it's not addictive, and it's organic. And people believed him, you know?
What year would this be?
Oh, it was like 67.
Really? That's that early?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And things spiraled out of control really fast, because you could buy a, you know, an 8-ounce bottle of Merc, brand cocaine sealed in a bottle for $50. And what came about was this thing we called the Coke Whore. And this woman wasn't there at all. She was just for a service unit item, but was unconscious, you know, for all. And this is like, man, this is what I signed up for, you know? And I got out of it. I was doing light shows, and I did, you know, all the different venues. And my partner, Alan Cooper, in the light shows at, you know, Redwood High. Guy, he's the father of Visual Basic, and he's doing a thing called Cooper.com, and he deals with IBM and Sony. It's just like me, you know. We wound up dealing with like the big guns, you know.
And when you're talking about this, you say this kind of incredulously, because you're just an outcast bike guy who's suddenly in the midst of all this.
Outcast bike guy, and then you go to be a stupid hippie, you know, mm-hmm. and it's like, oh man, nobody trusts you, right? And back in the day, they all thought we were crazy, mm-hmm. okay? Absolutely. And it's sort of the funny story of my life, you know, my brother, he did the other way, you know, pocket protector, tape around the glasses at Redwood High, Stanford, mathematics, electronics, goes to Tandem Computer, works as a hardware designer for 8 years. Then he goes and says, I want to get into business. Goes to Harvard, gets an MBA. Then he comes works with me. It's like we take completely different paths, and this is the way things work.
So let's get some context as far as time goes. So you're biking, and I want to go back just a little bit about the bike. I mean, the moment where you said there was nothing else for you by age 12.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember the bike, the moment? Was there a time when suddenly
it was like I would go on these rides with the other boys who'd be a little bit older than me and be into this, and it was like magic. You know, all of a sudden, my neighborhood went from, you know, 10 square blocks to like 20 miles, you know, all around me, and it was just a blast, you know, a really fun. And a lot of things went on. I spent a lot of time doing it. And man, I caught the bug something fierce. And I was, in the first year, I was doing these like 60 and 80 mile rides. And this old Englishman, Larry Walpole, and he was an East Side London guy who'd been a POW for a while. And he worked for Pan American as a mechanic. And that guy was hilarious. And there was more than one time he took a piece of fence wire, wired it onto my handlebars in the back of his bike, and towed my ass home. God bless him.
So you had, whatever reason it was, some kind of synergy between you and that bike.
Oh yeah, and it's not unusual. You know, now we all, now there's a lot of people that do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But to, let me ask, is it always been there?
Oh yeah.
I mean, has it ever receded?
It recedes when like and it's this thing, you get too buried in your work and your, and I'm really mission driven and whatever it takes to get this one done. You know, that's like, I grew up in this neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I'm realizing it now. When I was a teenager, I sort of resented, you know, growing up here.
Mm-hmm.
But I go into this into the yacht club there, and it's for all these people. Nobody works a 9-to-5 job. They create them. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
They do stuff and get stuff done. And there's, you know, I've made my mistakes and all that, fine. But let me tell you, the one thing that got ingrained in me and drilled in me in an early thing is like, think big, right?
So you're here, you're in Fairfax, you're working with New Writers of the Purple Stage?
Well, that was like just for a short period. You know, I was taking care of their house, the New Writers, and that was like in, like 72 or so.
What was their song? There was a song.
Oh, Panama Red was one, you know. There was a number of them. They did a bunch of stuff. They did pretty well in the album sales.
Yeah, I remember the era. And so you meet Charlie. The people say you should meet Charlie because Charlie's on his bike all the time.
All the time. He's a bike freak, and he's a roadie, and it's sort of perfect. And I just, you know, and that house was tenuous. You know, that they always free rent. Free rent's always tenuous.
Mm-hmm.
And so I moved into Charlie, and that was great. You know, it was wonderful. You know, and I started racing full time, you know, as much as I could. And, you know, I was working in a bike shop, and then I started working for Bicycling Magazine as a road tester. And that was fantastic because I got free equipment all the time. But even better than that, I went to all the bike trade shows, and I met everybody in the industry. There were very few at the time, but I met everybody. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And I had connections, you know. And then when I was racing, road racing a lot, and I'd moved out of Charlie's house, you know, into like, first I moved to a place in the center of Fairfax, and it was right behind 19 Broadway. And it was $120 a month, 5 rooms from Jerome Cialone at Cialone's, which later became 21 Broadway. And Jerome was, you know, and told me that W.C. Fields used to rent that place back in the day. And he showed me where the trap doors are, where the hooch was kept, you know.
So where exactly is this?
Right behind that 19 Broadway.
Ah.
You know, same music place. And I used to work there, you know, in the liquor store, you know, 2 nights a week. And it was great, you know, 4 to midnight. And the place didn't have any air conditioning, but you go in the back and sit in the cooler, literally sit in the cooler and watch for somebody to come in through the window. It was so much fun. So I was doing that, and then I was working for Fred Wolf, you know, which is part of one of Charlie's old friends in the moving business. And so I'd do that one day a week, and I could make my rent in one day. You know?
So how old are you here at this time?
I'm 65.
No, I mean, when you tell me the story.
That was when I was in my 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, I was a really good road racer. And I was back at the Olympic Training Center in 1979. And I was on the Olympic long team. And, you know, I was like third in the West Coast in Olympic development points. It was West, Central, and East. Then our president, Jimmy Carter, says, guess what? We're boycotting these ones. We're not going to Moscow. And at that moment, I said, well, it's time to start the mountain bike company. Because I'd been doing this, you know, and I'd done the thing with I put the multiple gears on a bike, which was, you know, some people make that, oh, this is some sort of science. Not at all. I don't agree. You know, it's really simple. And where did that come from? I used to ride cyclocross. Starting in 1964 was the first one. It's like a European version where, like, you got little cantilever brakes. You got, like, gears and everything, and those use tires that are 33 millimeters wide with knobs on them and everything, and what we were using, 52 millimeters wide. Okay, so that's the adjustment. You just make the frame a little bit bigger. It's not rocket science at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, making the bikes, and the bikes that I'm most proud of is when we went into business. You know, God, I mean, you could buy a Joe Brees bike for $750, and we used to snicker and say, well, the guy is working for 50 cents an hour. He only makes 10 bikes a year,
mm-hmm.
you know? And or you could buy like a Colnago, $450. I mean, full Campagnolo, really nice bike. You could buy a full custom Ben Sirota, $995. Incredible, beautiful bike, you know, incredible. And then our bike, my bike, I sold 160 of my bikes in the first year, $1,320, right? We used to tell people, you don't want a cheap parachute, and our bikes were exquisite. I had the best frame builder, you know, and I had, and Joe like says he designed my frame. Are you out of your mind? He didn't design my frame. He's, you know, I don't know where he got that from and what, you know, and it's not rocket science. All these frames, all of Joe's frames, all of my frames, all these guys' frames in the first 3 years were based, except for Mert Lowell. Mert Lowell was his own animal, and I love Mert, and I really regret not doing something with Mert if I ever had a regret. Anyway, almost everybody's frames, including Joe's and mine, were based on the, you know, the 1930s Schwinn Excelsior X. Exactly that geometry, but larger diameter tubing, mm-hmm. that's all. And thin wall chromoly tubing. And in fact, Joe sort of used mid-size stuff in his very first frame and put all these twin laterals on it. And the problem with that is it's really hard to make a straight frame when you do that, because you got all these little tiny tubes, you know, pulling and everything, and you got to do all the sequential welding and all this crazy stuff. So it's like, you know, I went off and, you know, I did my own thing. And I mean, I didn't wait for anybody else, so to speak. You know, I had my partner, Charlie, and Charlie was really good at getting stuff done, you know, and like the guy could drive a truck. He was a roadie, you know. Mm-hmm. So we go to trade shows and stuff, and man, we could pack up everything and leave at midnight, and the dude would drive all night long, and I could totally trust him completely. And the place, he'd always get there, everything would always be set up, and Charlie was the very best at building wheels, and Charlie had the greatest sense of humor, and Charlie could write really well. I mean, really well, you know. And that was a big part of the whole thing. I mean, you know, to me, I mean, we took it, we made it a business, and that's like, there's a bike, there's a university that specializes in bicycle, everything bicycle, in Trieste, Italy. They did a book about me, mm-hmm. and it's all about, I created a business, not just a bike, a business. You know, I created a name, mountain bike. You know, I created, I worked at the Japanese and got parts. I'm in Shimano's history book. I made a lot of money for those guys, but I worked with all the makers, you know, so we had competition and everything, so the price was good. My first big loan, you know where that came from? The Japanese government. Oh my goodness, because they recognized what I was doing. The first big show that we did to explain to the industry what was going on was in 1981 at the New York Bike Show. So at the bequest of Bicycling Magazine, Charlie and I did a big showing about mountain bikes. We were so lucky, we were so blessed. We had all these photographs from Larry and Wendy Craig that had been, you know, are still, you know, around today. They're fantastic, incredible, you know, like of the Sierra Nevadas, of the Rocky Mountains, of all this crazy stuff in Marin, including the repack race and everything. And Howie Hammerman was, one of the first mountain bikers. He was a, you know, he worked with Charlie as a roadie for the Sons of Champlin.
Mm-hmm.
And Howie was George Lucas's third employee. So we used to have a run of George's screening room at his house. You know, it was crazy. And we, once a month, we'd do like a slideshow there. We got good at it. So Charlie and I gave this presentation and we killed him in New York. You know, it was all the industry there. And they're going like, yeah, we know what mountain bike is. We know you're the guy that knows all about it. So I show up in Japan, they're like, hell yeah, we want to listen to this guy. And damn straight we want to make some of this equipment. And I got everybody to make stuff over there. And it was just incredible. You know, I mean, I'd be going to Japan like 7-8 times a year. And, you know, sometimes I'd spend like 3 weeks straight there and everything. And just working with those guys and getting the equipment going. So the first year we made 160 bikes. The second year we made 1,000. And in that 1,000, that was all Tom Ritchie's making frames.
Mm-hmm.
So Tom would, you know, I'd go down there with tubing, you know, and I'd deliver the tubing. And Dave and Devin worked for Tom for $5 an hour under the table. They cut the tubing and tack up the frames, you know. you know, do the prep work, so to speak. And Tom would do nothing but fillet braise, you know, and just put dues in bronze. And Tom got so good. Oh, my God. You know, he could put down this braising, and there was so little cleanup. It was insane. So we made, you know, this B frame as well as the A frame. And that allowed us to get a bike at a $995 price point. And that we went to $1,000 the next year. I mean, we had a line out the door, and we were delivering a lot of bikes. So I'd pick up the frame, just the frames, not the forks, just the frames, the bare frames at Tom's place. And I'd take it to, I had three painters. I had seven people making wheels. And we had this little place at 1501 San Anselmo Avenue where we used to ask people, I hope you've had experience working in a submarine. That is, people that wanted to work for us. Because it's really cramped in here, you know, and we were bringing in all this stuff. And then we had Joe Burry, holy mackerel, this kid, he put together 14 bikes in one day, broke the record. Then he became a racer, and man, and in the meantime, we got every magazine, every, you know, all these different news articles and TV stuff, because we were working the PR really well, because my mom taught me.
That this is going to be my next question. I mean,
yeah.
This is your business is really in essence your first pancake. I mean, this is evolving. It seems to be just.
Well, I'd failed a couple times before. I did a Christmas tree lot, and I allowed a couple of employees to rip me off, and that was when I was 16. And I did when I did the light show, and the light show like sort of lost its whole. You know, they were paying $100 an hour. That was stupid. You know, we were burning $100 worth of bulbs a night, you know? And that was
so,
a mess.
So I mean, you've jumped, but you've jumped into a business. You're a hippie guy. I mean, you live in the hippie world, but it seems as if you have some sort of...
Yeah, but you got to realize, I mean, okay, let's go back to the hippie world. Like, this was the notion. I mean, the Haight-Ashbury was a cool place for about 6 months, and then it went south. And it was this whole thing of like sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and we tell you it's all for free. That was really, it was supposed to be a whole conscious raising thing, you know, come on, you know, and it went south. I mean, completely, and all these stupid kids still come out to the Haight to this day thinking it's just sex, drugs, and rock and roll and all this. And that, it was a better way of living, and that's the way I want to be. That's what I want to do, and that's why I got back into bikes and got sort of out of that scene in a way. I mean, there's certain aspects of it I totally appreciate to this day and everything, but no, I'm not a stupid hippie. Thank you very much. I never was a stupid hippie.
You know, I mean, in the sense, but you've gone. You suddenly you've got a professional career.
Yeah.
You are presenting yourself. What you're describing, we had a little short break there for a moment. The way you're describing your business and the acumen in which you seem to display your ability to represent yourself and the era of bicycling that you're bringing forward. I mean, you said you mentioned that you created the name Mountain Bike.
Yeah, we started a company called Mountain Bikes, and we needed an original name. I'm not going to name it after like the pastime or something. Give me a break. And there was no one. I mean, I thought of that in my head. Now, of course, someone else thought of that word somewhere else. But we put it out there, and for a number of years, we put it out worldwide. I mean, we shipped bikes worldwide, and we had stories worldwide, and nobody came after us saying, no, that's my name, and I had it first.
So what is the name of your first business? With
Mountain Bikes.
Mountain Bikes, that was
it. Yes, plural.
But your bikes that you make now are Gary Fisher's, right?
That's right. And that's like we failed to trademark it properly. It went generic. We let it go generic too much.
So the Mountain Bike is a generic name.
It is now.
Yeah.
It is now. But I thought of that name. I put it out there. It was my name. And I can rightfully say I made the first mountain bike, right? Mm-hmm. You know, because it's like the fat tire bike. You go back like, okay, one of my first people that put money into the company, John Finley Scott. And he was a UC Davis professor, you know, and he did the Davis Double Century, and he made himself what he called a woodsy bike in 1953. Okay, and that had multiple gears, although the gears weren't so effective in that it had a single front chainring, therefore the chain can fall off really easily. It had a three-speed rear Sturmey Archer hub, And in our experience, we could not make one of those things put up with the intense going up steep hills.
Mm-hmm.
It had a lousy caliper brake on the front. There's a little brake that went on a steel chrome-plated rim, which is totally worthless in the wet, you know, completely worthless. And it had a small, you know, this Sturmey Archer drum brake, a small diameter one. And in our experience, the small diameter drum brakes would overheat and fail really quickly. So he had a bike that didn't work. You know what I'm saying? And
he had an idea, but the bike didn't really.
Well, that one didn't really work. And then you go back further. Like, so there were some guys in France in the 40s. They had shocks. They had multiple gears. They had, you know, knobby tires, not quite as big as ours. They did jumps and crazy stuff like that. And we find this out, you know, 20 years after we're all been making bikes. We find out about this. And they kept it to themselves. They didn't make a craze. I made a worldwide craze.
Yes.
I created a million jobs, you know, and there are a lot of people doing this. And I changed the bike industry. And what I was saying before, what I was most proud of, is I changed people's perception of what a bicycle should cost. And that's happened a few times. I mean, they did that with a Trek, did it recently with all our carbon fiber frames.
Mm-hmm.
For better or for worse, Lance Armstrong and everything.
Because mm-hmm.
It's one of these things of, you know, you have a great, incredible groundbreaking design. You hype the living shit out of it. And then it's not vaporware. People can actually buy it and use it, and it actually works, you know. And that's, I pulled that one off already with this. And I done it again like, 10 years ago with this whole 29er thing, which is another thing where, like, it's just a wheel size. You know, and to do that too, I mean, one of the things I had to do was go to the Union Cycliste International, the guys in Switzerland, and say, change your rule. And they did for me, because I'm powerful. I'm powerful as can be, like you can't believe. It's crazy. And this is like, it's a crazy thing, you know, and I'm still like a really, I've learned to be not such a control freak.
Are you a control freak?
Well, everybody that does a lot of these things to some degree is, you know. And then you learn, it's like the serenity prayer.
Yeah.
Dear Lord, give me the wisdom, right, to know what you can change and what you can't. Because, man, there's a lot of stuff like you just beating your head against the wall. And there are other things, man. All you got to do is go, just a little snap, a little suggestion, a whisper in the air, and it's amazing what can happen. And I've been able to tune into more of those lately, you know, and that's been really satisfying just to watch that happen. And what's going on lately is more urban infrastructure and sort of future thought of what's going to happen. And, you know, it's like things like, you know, you realize it's like 100 years ago, any family of means would raise their kids in the city because that's where culture was. So what we got going on, you know, like in the last 40 years has been an anomaly. Really has been. And when you think about what happened, you know, 40, 50 years ago, was our president, Eisenhower, built the interstate freeway system and enabled developers, architects, you know, to create the suburbs. And money rules. It makes things happen, you know. And what's happening is people are coming back into the cities. Only 18% of Americans live outside of a city now.
Mm-hmm.
And the city leaders worldwide are saying, what am I going to do to make my place a cool place? So that's what I've been doing. I mean, I've been going around to city leaders, and they've been accepting me, you know, to come in and talk and to be in front of the media.
And your part in that is to bring in, I guess, the greening of the cities through bikes versus cars?
Well, it's a lot bigger than that. It's like I'll say, let's take a third of these streets and tear the pavement out completely. Let's put gardens in there. Now think about it. Now think about the inconvenience you'd have if you couldn't drive up to your garage. Now think about this. Would you like to live on that street? Think about it. It's going to be quiet. There's going to be gardens all over, fruits and vegetables and things. Do you think your property values will go up? I think they will.
Mm-hmm.
I'd want to take another third of the streets, and they're just going to be walking, slow biking, you know, shopping. Last third of the streets, the new transit, the transit that's going to come, isn't going to be on rail because the public has to buy into that. And there are great forces in this country against public transit, as you know. What's going to bring it in will be the private side. And that'll be people like Apple and Google and Tesla and Ford and Chevy and Volkswagen and Mercedes and Audi. They're all working on this autonomous car. And this car that you, the autonomous car, it's not going to be a car that you recognize today. It'd be this little tiny thing. It'll have a tour. If it two people would just be as wide as, you know, a business class seat, you know, two of them or four, where you face each other, and this thing, you'll order it up like an Uber car, right? You won't own the thing. So what happens, and it'll come to you in the morning, bring you your breakfast, bring you your coffee, or you can just sleep on the way to work. And think of it, on the way home, you will never get a DUI again. And there'll be cities and places where this is going on already, and it's all be electric too, because
yeah,
that's the other
thing. How's this going to get around? This is going to be on an electric,
No, driverless. There is a technology. It's already here. It's coming so quickly. You know, you can't believe it.
And where do these little pod cars live?
They live in the street. See, that's the point. Is right now, 30-35% of American cities are dedicated to parking lots and parking structures. And man, that's like a lot of space that we can have back, because we won't need that parking, because we won't let the regular cars in there and do this thing. A car spends 95% of its life parked. You know, and there's cities now, in Germany in particular, where they're going on a whole program of no combustion vehicles inside the perimeter of the inner city because of the fine particulates. Fine particulates kill about 45,000 Americans a year prematurely. Premature defined as 12 years or more. So it's a bigger issue than people want to recognize here.
So what you've started with in your biking, innovation, creating something that actually had been around, and it was logical to have around a bike with fatter tire and all that, but actually making it, jumping in and doing it. I mean, did you ever hesitate? Did you ever think to yourself, as an innovator, which is what you are, did you ever think I'm going to innovate, or did it just come out of you? Is stuff always coming out of you?
Well, I mean, as far as like, I've always made weird stuff. It's like, you see all the light show equipment I made? That was all weird optics and things and ways of doing things that nobody had ever made before. It was all homemade, all that stuff. And, you know, to the houses I had, I mean, one time we used to take care of Slide Ranch, you know, I forget the name of it. You know, it's the same people today.
Doug Ferguson, I interviewed him. He talked about the Grateful Dead hippies living in Slide Ranch.
We were there. That was us.
Yes.
That was us. And, like, I built an incredible tree fort there. My friend Richard Martinez, you know, like all shingled and everything, like in these big eucalyptus trees. We had, like, these incredible teepees. Oh my God! We harvested.
So
all
you were
the
one of the. Oh, but
I was.
There's quite a story, as Doug tells it, that you guys said that you could do something.
Eddie Washington was a guy, our connection with the Nature Conservancy.
The Nature Conservancy,
that was
right?
Yeah, you know, and I built one time in Mill Valley. This is my second place in Mill Valley. I built myself an apartment from a 12-foot diameter wine barrel, redwood wine barrel. You strike it, and you can smell the red wine.
Okay, let's just stop, because this is about Mill Valley.
Stuff.
I want to hear a little more about this wine barrel house, because it is good that we bring
it. I had
it
a
back
view of Mount Tamalpais. It was perfect and nothing else.
I have not heard about a wine barrel house
I
yet.
I made that.
Where is it? Tell me.
It went away. It was not
Where
Dakota.
Was it once?
I could show you on the map here. I forget the name of the street. I think, it was so long ago.
But
I had a place there that I built once.
On someone's property?
Oh, yeah. They were gone. Or we built it. And then later, you know, their neighbors busted them. And they had to get rid of it.
How big is it?
It was 12 foot in diameter. Uh-huh. And it was 14 feet high. So uh-huh. I had like a loft in it. And it was really cool. I built all by myself. Can you imagine? All the staves, all that stuff. I did it all by myself. Built the foundation, the whole thing. And I was like 17. I used to like to do stuff like that a lot. And I'm still, you know, my apartment here has got what people would say is sort of crazy stuff, you know.
Well, I did notice when I went into your apartment that the dining room wouldn't really, I wouldn't describe it, that would be the ambiance of that room. I would say more of a bike cellar.
No, the bikes don't always live there. It's nicer when the bikes are out of there.
No, it reminds me of what Charlie, I asked what your, Charlie, when I interviewed him, yeah. Charlie Kelly asked what your place was in Fairfax, what were the rooms like, and how would you describe those rooms?
Well, it was in the living room, there was a bike stand and a workbench. It really was functional. And we had bikes, we had bike hooks on the wall so you could hang a whole bunch of bikes up, and that was great. But we also had the wherewithal of to go out and get a whole bunch of big, long planks, 12 bys, and make a huge banquet. One time we made a huge banquet table there, you know, for the whole club, because that was where I was at. I mean, my mother taught me that. My grandmother taught me that. This is how you have a dinner, you know? It's like what Californians do. It's like L.A. Confidential, the movie, all right? Mm-hmm. My great-grandfather, who owned the San Diego Transit System, his house is the house Kim Basinger's in that movie.
Oh, that beautiful bungalow place.
Oh, man, my mother pulls out the original Architectural Digest piece on it, you know, the whole thing. It's like that. It's like, you know, and she knows how to, like, make a table, you know, place cards for everybody, and a gentleman between courses trade, and it's always interesting. She sets it up that way in the social, you know, because this is what we're talking about.
This is an era. This is a time.
It runs things. I mean, my God, the story. Come on. That's what sells, you know. And that's the thing. She taught me publicity, as did my grandfather. And it's made such an incredible difference. And my great-grandfather, ran San Diego Transit, he was famous for speaking. And I got stuff. It just comes out of my mouth so easily. I never, you know, and people go, that is incredible. You know, all the time now. It's wild. So I got...
Maybe you've just been around so long, you've got an arsenal of...
I definitely do. There's no doubt about that.
To draw from.
Yeah.
Tell me, with your bike business, I'm just suddenly quite distracted by your socks.
No, my socks.
Classic, very nice. Those are purple.
Paul Smith,
very
nice. I designed a bike up Paul Smith once.
You
did. He's a friend.
Now you're older, you've had the bike business,
mm-hmm.
you've had a few lives.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
If you could tell me the lives as you see them, if you could.
Well, I've had kids. Mm-hmm. I've had women. Holy mackerel! I mean, it's been a long time since I haven't had a girlfriend or a wife. I mean, a serial monogamist. And those two things right there, I mean, that's like the majority of my time. And then I've got riding a bike. And boy, that's a lot of time, too. Oof, you spend 20, 25 hours a week riding your bike. Just the riding part, not the resting part or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And then the business, to be honest, with the business, you know, I've worked less hard than you could ever believe.
But was your head in it all the time? Were you always
thinking? Oh, my head's always in it. You know, it's one of those things where, like, I'm always thinking about it.
You know, because when you say you work, sometimes I, in interviewing these bike people, it's work, life, it's not... that 9-to-5 kind of concept. It's a lifestyle choice.
But a lot of bike guys, oh man, especially like the guys working in the shops, they're working for long hours. Oh man, it's hilarious. They always say, well, I used to ride a bike, then I bought this bike shop. And they work like dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's never been something I've been that super fond of. You know, I mean, at one point I went and worked at the Trident restaurant. You know, I started as a dishwasher, and I moved up to cold side. And I really got along with Pierre, you know, the head chef. And, like, I thought about it the other day. I could have totally got into being a chef. But you know what? Man, that is a hard job, and that's hard working. And until you write some books and get into some TV and stuff, and TV didn't exist then. Ha, 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 you know. And until you do, and you're a celebrity and stuff, There's a few guys that get out, but that's a hard working job.
Yeah.
You know, and you think about what I do and what I, you know, I'm an entrepreneur,
mm-hmm.
and I'm an idea guy, and I come up with the ideas, and I come up with solutions. You know, I get people to calm down, I get people to think, and I get people to solve their problems all by themselves.
And how do you get these people in your court?
Is you got to have empathy, and you really got to stand in their shoes. You got to understand it from their side. Goodness gracious, huh? Figure out what's going on here, right? You know, figure if you don't, you can always figure out your side. Man, that's coming out you loud and clear, and maybe way too loud. And you got to tone that down, and go over to the other side, and then you have half a chance of making a really good solution.
Well, that's interesting what you're saying. When did that part of the equation occur to you?
Oh, it's been coming along the whole time. You know, there have been times when, you know, I hate on some guy and then I wonder why he hates me. You know, there's been all kinds of crazy stuff where it's like, I got a flat spot in my head. I got to stop pounding my head on this wall, you know. And it's going back to that serenity prayer, what you can't do and you can't. And sometimes when you take the pressure off is when things are allowed to happen.
Do you have particular individuals in your life that you feel have influenced you
Definitely. There's quite a number, you know, quite a number, you know, quite a number. And it's sort of like I try to allow to have somebody to influence me each and every day. And then there are some that have been there the whole time, you know. And you, like my grandfather, I mean, he's gone, you know, 25 years, and there's not a day I don't think about him. Not a day.
And which one, which grandfather?
Oh, my grandfather, Fred Applegate. And then, you know, my father, you know, he's like here now, and we talk, you know.
Really? Your father's still alive?
Oh, yeah. So that's really great. He's here, you know. We spend more and more time with him, you know, and talking with him about important things, because he's been through a lot. He's done a lot, you know. And then there's just many others, you know, that have wisdom. You know, and it's, we got our church, we got like my wife, we got like all these, you know, her family and everything. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. My brother, oh my goodness. I mean, that guy is such the great analyst of things. And such a great pragmatist, you know. And it's just we're blessed in that way. You know, we're really, really lucky that we've got these experienced, just steady, rational people in my life, you know, to help me. I've really valued it, you know.
I think something that I think is important in these interviews is to discuss the community and what community does. You know, it's a very busy world, and I've interviewed a lot of people, and they talk about what this area was like once and what it's like now, and
yeah.
and where what community is, and maybe you'd like to speak a little bit about that.
Well, it's changed, of course. You know, it's like Mill Valley used to be this cool little place, you know, and it's just all now money's there and everything. It's totally changed. It's really funny because it's the same place, and so far as like, it's no bigger than it used to be. There's no big, huge developments that have really changed things since, you know, I think the last developments went in there in the 60s or something.
Mm-hmm.
But people do a lot more and they get a lot more money. That's okay. I don't mind that at all. It's Marin is a strange place. I mean, it's the oldest county in the whole Bay Area. We tend to complain a lot about one thing, traffic.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do anything about it. It sort of cracks me up.
But there is community here.
Oh,
there's
you're a
huge describing
community.
In your life.
Community. Oh yeah, because we got you know, you go up and see the set, you know, go up to Mount Tam, go to, you know, go to Bolinas, go to Bobo, you know. It's still, you know, yeah. You know, and that's, I came back here, I didn't really expect. We're living in the city, in the middle of the city. We came back to
you and your wife now?
Yeah.
When you, now, people don't know this, but you have a new baby boy.
I do. He's 8 months old, and he's incredible. And it's just a miracle, you know, that he's here and everything, and he's beautiful and robust, and he's changed so many things to the positive in my family and with everything.
So were you living in the city with your wife and your wife's name is?
Alex.
Alex.
And we were living in the city. We were there for about 8 years, and I hadn't lived with my parents since I was a teenager, or lived here, you know. And
wow.
We came back, and it's been, I lost a button. And it's been great.
So you've come home, you're 65 years old, you have an 8-month-old son and a
yes,
beautiful wife.
I do.
Who's a physician and in the community, you know, big family. And you're back home and your folks are alive. Small town boy comes home.
Yeah. No, small town boy comes home. And then just lately I've been getting all kinds of opportunities brought my way to do more of what I really want to do, which is, I'm not sad. You know, I get lifetime achievement awards. Every year or two I get one, you know, from somebody in the mountain bike world.
Uh-huh.
And I want to do more. That's the thing.
He says with the twinkle in his eye,
yeah,
you've got more life to go here.
Right. And
you want to do more. Mountain biking more or in all new directions?
No, it's bringing more health and vitality to our people. And that's what the mountain bike did. It brought some helping of health and vitality. But this time it's more back to my roots working with infrastructure and changing things in the cities. And in our cities, our suburbs, in the way we live, and our lifestyles, and changing that, because I mean, we got crises right now, health crises, that is. And even my Republican friends can totally relate to the fact that 17% of gross domestic product is spent in the United States on health care, versus all these other first world countries that are running their healthcare systems from 9 to 11%. You think about that spread, that, you know, even the 6% spread, that spread of gross domestic product, that's actually bigger than the Chinese debt and the federal debt put together. And people just act as if nothing's happening. This is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's the other part that's crazy. For the first time in American history, your children are not going to live as long as you do. Lifespan is going south. And I want to know what kind of plan anybody has for it, because I've got a plan. And it's like I was describing before, you know, we're going to do this with the streets.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have this driverless car. We sort of got stuck on that one. That's sort of like the new railway, because
mm-hmm.
you don't have to buy rails.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole point of it, you know. They've already got it mapped out. It's amazing. The other thing is going to be safe routes to school, but man, we're going to do it like Ray's Indoor Mountain Bike Park. And this, I've got to show you, because you don't know what this is about. This guy's been around for the last 14 years, and he builds all these trails and things out of wood, and even for beginners. And this guy takes people off of the street, he herds them around, they all have a great time, and nobody kills each other. It's all made out of wood. And I'm talking about drilling through buildings, going straight over streets and things, so that this is our kids. And our kids had a lot of fun coming to and from school.
Where's the prototype for this?
It's, he's got a place in Cleveland and in Milwaukee.
These people contact you, or do you find them?
I know them. I go around, this is the point that's great about being old. You've been around,
uh-huh.
you know, and you've seen all this stuff, you know, and you hear about it and everything. I am pretty obsessed with, like, being tuned into what's going on in the scene. And I know Ray. I've known Ray for some time, you know, and we're talking. You know, I'm going to use one of his artists to, like, help me illustrate more of this stuff. I'm working with different artists right now,
mm-hmm.
and I want to be able to show people.
I wish people could see that your face right now, because
yeah.
you sort of look like, I don't know how to describe it, rather childlike. I mean,
it's hilarious, because all it is I'm going to make paradise and make it work. Because
uh-huh.
Back to what I was saying before, 100 years ago, they thought of the cities as paradise. And then we sort of screwed up. You know, cars don't work in cities. They don't work. At 1.3 passengers per vehicle, there's no way. It's not going to move enough people around. That's
mm-hmm.
all there is to it in a city. And cities like to be, you like a city to be dense enough so you can walk around and get somewhere.
Yeah.
You know? That's the charm of a city. And people love it. They're sick and tired of watching TV. Great Wasteland. Oh, it develops your waist too. Yeah. It's like this vicarious lifestyle is not being sold to the millennials right now. Mm-hmm. They're not going for it. Mm-hmm. They don't want to buy a car. They want to take the $7,000 that they save per year by not having a car, put it in their back pocket and pay for rent and food. Come on. And they love the idea of going on some sort of transit where they can sit there and communicate with their friends, because they think driving is boring. And it is boring. It's boring and it's stressful. And we got all the stats, all the peer-reviewed medical stats now that say, look, you do too much of this, it's killing you, you know? Just sitting in a chair, you know, being online kills people, we know this. Mm-hmm. And the car is just, you know, pretty much the same. And even taking a kid in the bus everywhere. Like Tiburon, we got the bus system to, you know, alleviate part of our traffic problem. Mm-hmm. But a bigger problem is like, man, we got to take care of our kids. And we know that, like, running a motor for a half hour in the morning for a kid, that is their internal motor, makes them smarter.
Mm-hmm.
And calms them down and stuff. Keeps that type 2 diabetes away from single-digit players. You know, mm-hmm. That's, our kids are getting that when they're under 10. It's crazy.
So do people come to you, because you're who you are with your bikes, you have a certain level of fame as the bike man, right?
Yeah.
So when you're at a show or you're speaking, mm-hmm. or you're doing something like this, and people come up to you, I imagine, afterwards, yes?
Yeah.
What do they say to you?
Well, it's like, it's like I get on an airplane and people stop me all the time.
You're recognizable wherever you go?
When I go and do a good job, like I was in India, you know, and I tell these guys, if you do a good job, the press guys, and I got interviewed by 147 different press people, mm-hmm. yeah, including the Times in India, the whole thing, while I was there. The guy at Customs will know who I am, and the guy at Customs knew who I am, was there. I go to Europe, most of the guys at Customs know who I am. I'm the most popular mountain biker in the world. I'm right now, there's an organization down in Santa Monica, and they track everybody, figure out how famous you are. Number 15 in bike people right now. It's all you've done with algorithms, right? And you go look at how many articles you're in, how many movies, how many this, how many that. It's
about being. Of course they would do that.
Okay, it's fame. It's not popularity.
Yeah, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, Lance Armstrong is the most famous
cyclist. Did you meet Lance Armstrong?
I've met him a few times. I've talked to him about 40 words, you know. And one of those, I did a signing down in his bike shop in Austin. And most of the 30 of those words is, Lance, I've done something for you. Now, you're going to sign this poster, and you're going to put my mother's name and happy birthday, Saloma. He never writes that kind of stuff. Well, he did for me because I asked him.
Your mom wants the autograph.
Yeah,
pictures.
This counts.
What
that
do
counts.
Your parents say? Is your mom alive still?
Oh, yeah.
Both your parents are alive?
Oh, my mom is so happy she holds that little boy. Oh, my God. It's so good.
What did they think about your taking on the bike business when you were
there? They thought it was crazy at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I got like a number of different advisors, you know. A couple were from the family, a couple from outside of the family, and I did everything they said.
Mm-hmm. You know? Oh, really?
And, yeah, we made a lot of money. We would make a lot of money, then we wouldn't make money, then we'd make a lot of money, then we wouldn't make money. It was up and down for a while, and we were like at an uncomfortable size. You know, we needed to either be small and boutique-y, or we needed to be about $55 million in sales, mm-hmm. and you know, for the economy of scale, and we were at about $10 million. And it was like, leveraged out like crazy, and the money was double digits was the interest, and the currency was all over the place, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then all of a sudden people wanted to buy us all over the place, you know. Mm-hmm. So my brother and I sold the company, and on the first go around we sold to some Taiwan guys, and that was crazy. It was nuts, and I pulled the whole thing off, which will be on my next book, and it'll blow your freaking mind how I landed on my feet on that, because everything I got totally like manipulated light to. It was incredible, you know.
Would you call yourself a trusting man?
Definitely. But now I get I'm very, very, very careful who I get into bed with. You know, that's everything. Yeah, and that's like, it's good. My oldest son has got that going for him. And he's got a fiance right now, but man, he's a beautiful boy. Beautiful, 27-year-old, cool kid. But
Do you are you involved with the Marin bicycling, the museum, the new museum?
Not really.
Have you been?
I haven't been. It's not my gig. I got a museum I'm in. The museum I'm in is in Reno, Shields, and I love those guys. And they're out of Fargo, North Dakota. And I worked with them for a couple of weeks. They had a beautiful museum, a story of a ton of my stuff in there. 7,000 people a day walk past that museum. The one in Fairfax, I don't know if that's going to be around in 3 years. I look at their financials and I sort of, I got to not talk about that. But you know?
Where are your bikes? You've made your first Gary Fisher bike when? What year?
Oh, and what? Well, technically that wasn't until 83, 84, okay. When I split up with Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically.
As you described, you said that you divorced him.
Yeah, in a way. It was like, we were in debt. And then I turned it around and made a whole bunch of money within, about 3 or 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And we just weren't clicking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said, nah, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do that, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do that. And pretty soon he was just building wheels. And it was
do
like.
Do you still see each other?
Oh, yeah. Charlie's a sweetheart. He's in a lot of measures, although I don't know. I don't know if I want to say anymore.
You've had a big life.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a good one. You know, a lot of opportunity, a lot of really good friends. A lot of people in the business are friends. You know, amazing.
Like names?
Oh, Antonio Colombo. I saw him down at Interbike. And, the owner of Cinelli. And, Columbus Tubing and all that. I designed tubing for him. I designed bikes for him. And he's a total art freak. Oh, he did an exhibit with Zoe Zegler, out of Mill Valley and everything, in Milano, anytime you want to come work for me, anytime, Gary. Well, we love each other so much. And, the Shimano brothers are still really good friends.
Mm-hmm.
And the president of SRAM, Stan Day, really good friend. And, Valentino Campagnolo, really good friend. And I've had Rosetto at his house, and same with the Shimano brothers at their house, And who else? Todd Slavey from GT Bikes. He's a competitor of mine, but man, we just really get along. Oh, Mike Sinyard from Specialized. All these other guys have bag on him because he's big and powerful. Mean at times, But Mike, he calls me up a few days before the Grateful Dead concert down in Santa Clara and says, hey man, I got extra tickets, you want to come? I said, yeah, I'll go for you, Mike. Because everybody thinks, we've been competitors like this, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, and he's got a really big company, And I go down there and it's like, there's not a single Specialized employee there. It's just Mike, his wife, and a guy named CJ. And we're at the Levi's Stadium, and we're in his suite, CJ's suite, and CJ's the president, the brand president of Levi's. And it's like, wow, cool, and I brought my wife, and so I meet CJ. CJ's all stoked to see me. I'm wearing a Levi's jacket, just out of total coincidence, And I'd been invited to go with Mountain Girl, but she was pretty busy, taking care of ex-Grateful Dead employees, making sure they had the right place. I said, what the heck, I'll just take these.
Mm-hmm.
And it was incredible. We go, CJ's got the tickets for the floor. We go down on the floor, end of the first set. And like, all of a sudden, there's this rainbow, right? And then it's like, I'm thinking, CJ, you would know this is your place. Did you do this? Did you do this? This rainbow, CJ, did you do this? He's going, no, man, this is the this is on the next. You call up Mountain Girl. It's real. It's real. I got the man right here. It's real. It's real.
the thing about the interesting story, I think, about the era that you've been involved in the mountain biking, it's so much more than just biking.
Oh, yeah.
It's a time and place. The Grateful Dead, the music.
Well, Mount Tam.
Mount Tam.
Okay, let's
talk about Mount Tam.
Mount Tam. Oh, my God. You know, this is a very special place. This is the birthplace of low growth. So in the 60s, the developers wanted to come to Marin and take it from 220,000 to 1.4 million. And it was the Audubon Society and the Sierra Club that fought tooth and nail and beat them, basically. We were going to have a freeway that went along Highway 1 out to Olema and another freeway out to Sir Francis Drake. And we were going to have Marinicello, this huge, you know, subdivision out in the headlands. And a Bolinas Lagoon was going to be a marina and dredged out and everything. And, well, quite arguably, after that occurrence, the Sierra Club and the Audubon Society, they owned the mountain, right? And then we came along, right? It was first the hippies, right? And you could take your Volkswagen bus or whatever you wanted and take it out into the woods. I would take my mother's Chevy Impala, you know, just drive it out there, right? You could drive on the firewood. So there was nothing out there. Just no chains, no nothing. Then the water district put up chains. That was easy for them to do. Then the bike became the golden key out there. And my high school buddies at Redwood High were the Larkspur Canyon Gang. And that was because of drum circles. Casey Sauna Band and the Drum Circles and Todd Beeson and all these guys, you know, like the drum circles. And we go out in the woods and people would drag conga drums out there. Dickens Bascom, holy mackerel. Do you remember him?
Yeah.
Oh, he did the first decorated car. They're still sitting over there in Sausalito.
Oh, the Unknown Museum in Mill Valley.
I was one time,
with 50 TV sets with doll heads in them on the
Right. Well, we did. He originally, I've got one of his posters in my house, an old one from the Haight. And he lived in Larkspur Canyon, mm-hmm. and he corrupted all us young boys at Redwood High. Oh, my God. And, you know, those guys, they were like, hey, we know you're into bikes, so you got to come out with us and check this out. It was like that. And I'd ride my bike to school sometimes. You know, one time I rode my track bike to Redwood High, and I was a senior, and his junior, Robin Williams, wanted to ride my track bike. Well, I let him ride my track bike around the parking lot, and on that bike, you can't coast, right? It's a fixed gear, and so Robin forgets, he goes over the handlebars, and he had to have his spleen removed.
Get out.
My bike.
But he became quite a bicyclist.
Well, I rode with him about 3 times. That's it. I didn't hang out with him so much. That guy, you know, I want a photo of him, and underneath it says scholar. You think about it. That guy is one of the hardest working people you'll ever meet, you know?
He worked at the Trident as a busboy, too.
Yeah.
Because
all the pretty girls were there. That's why we worked there. Come on. It was a place. It was something, you know? Frank Werber, you know?
I knew Frank Werber.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
It was something. It was beautiful, you know? Yes. All that painted ceilings and all that woodwork and everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was incredible.
So I know that your son's going to be coming here soon, but before we close, I want to ask a couple things.
Sure.
When you're thinking about this area and how it's influenced you, I mean, if you were to consolidate in some way to say how being here at your time and place and how we are here today and being raised here, how would you describe your relationship to this area, how it's formed you and how you've formed this area in your own way as well?
Well, it's extremely stimulating. It hasn't been something that I've been totally in love with. And but I think now I like that even better, you know, because it gives you a lot. There's all this pressure and stuff. Absolutely. You know it. There's plenty of pressure in this county.
Mm-hmm.
But then you got this place that's absolute serenity. I mean, it's totally beautiful. And it's a brilliant combination. And it really, there's some places in the world that have it. I mean, not that many. And I've always appreciated it, you know, that the air is coming in through the Pacific and everything's so clean and nice.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand,
man, we can make it hard on ourselves in this county for no good reason. And you know what I'm talking about. And it's people, you know, people just being people, you know. We are so hard on ourselves as people.
Ugh. What would you do different? How would you wish it to be different?
Well, this is a grand challenge for me, because the hardest thing to change is a gray matter between the ears. And, you know, it's like they used to say, go to New York City. You know, if you can master this, you can do it anywhere. Well, if I can master Marin County, I can master anywhere.
And your greatest challenge here, in your desire to master?
Is to bring a lot more happiness. Because there's a lot of angst in this beautiful little county of ours. You know, an undue amount. It really is.
Why do you think?
Well, because it's very competitive. Mm-hmm. It's competitive just by price and prestige. And then, you know, we got a completely non-existent transit system or mm-hmm. and our transportation system. You know, the car system is a mess here, mm-hmm. you know, as it is like in most places. And people, they're just frustrated with that. And it's like this. Everybody that comes from Marin is very special. Wherever they came from, they were extremely special people. And then they come to Marin and they got to line up with all the other special people. And then some people get really hyphy about it because they're no longer special. And that's what you got going on here. That's the hard part about here.
So
it's not like going to the Midwest where everybody like is all super happy to be in line with each other. It's not like that. You know, I don't mind that at all. You know, I like the East Coast, West Coast pressure. You know, it's a competitive place. You know, and I mean, LA is a competitive place. New York's a competitive place. And San Francisco, well, guess what? It's become a super competitive place. And there's a lot of money there, a lot of good jobs, and a lot of people live here. And, well, they're type A, you know, so am I. You know?
So I guess what you're saying then is your idea of a better Marin County is for you to have this competitiveness, the stress,
yeah.
or the pressure, whatever it is that evokes whatever creativity comes from being all these good minds together, but with paradise and calm
It's more like this. It's more a periodization thing. There's nothing wrong with pressure as long as you get time to recover. That's the point. People that are under pressure, it could be mild pressure as long as it's constant and it never lets up, they're the ones that die. Mm-hmm. That kills you. You know, whereas pressure and then no pressure, that's good.
Oh,
hey, here we go.
I think we're going to have to I think your child is here.
Here we go. He trumps everything.
Okay, let us put this pause for a moment. So, Gary, your 8-month-old son has just arrived, and as a mother, I know that our time is now close because you've got your boy here, and I just want to say thank you for your insights. Thank you for contributing to our oral history program. Thank you for bringing to the library and to all the listeners a time, place, and a personal experience that is so unique just to you, and that we can, you know, to just be able to hear the story offers us a broader perspective for what it is to grow up here and the kind of life you've had and the influence that you've had on the county. So thank you so much for that.
It's been my pleasure to share this. What I feel like is I've been really lucky.